This is the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast, episode 89. Good day and welcome to this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. I'm your host, podcaster, and author of Fun Fantasy Reads, Jamie Davis. This podcast is exactly what the title says it is, folks. It's a show focused on everything to do with fantasy books, from epic fantasy to urban fantasy, swords and sorcery, or anything else you can think of in between. Expect to find the best and brightest authors from all the various corners of the fantasy book world here on the show. Plus, we'll add some other special guests along the way, so keep your eyes open for that, too. To start off things this week, I'll begin with my own author update. I'm prepping things to get ready for the release of Huntress Cadet, Book 3 in the Huntress Clan Saga. That comes out next week on Tuesday, February 25th. I'm excited about it. Check out my reader group on Facebook for a sneak peek at the new cover design before anyone else gets to see it. That should be coming out soon. If you haven't already started this awesome series, you can check out Book 1, Huntress Initiate. It's available on Amazon. You can check that out. I also just wrapped up writing Book 8 in my Extreme Medical Services series, just getting the first draft done, so it's still got some editing to go for a little bit. It's going to be titled The Paramedics Amazon. I hope you all enjoy it. I haven't written anything in that series for about a year, so this is the first new book coming out in that series. If you haven't already delved into this series, Book 1 is the same as the series title, Extreme Medical Services. So check that out. You can also find out more information about everything I'm up to, including sneak peeks of upcoming covers, special giveaways, and a lot more by visiting my fan group on Facebook at Jamie's Fun Fantasy Readers and over at my website and blog, jamiedavisbooks.com. I look forward to hearing from you. I try to respond back to every email and Twitter post and everything else that comes in, so please reach out to me. All right, let's get into this episode. Today's show, I interview Sebastian De Castel. Sebastian is just finished getting a degree in archaeology, and he started working on his first dig and 4 hours later realized how much he hated archaeology. Don't you hate when that happens? He left to pursue a very focused career as a musician, an ombudsman, an interaction designer, fight choreographer, teacher, project manager, actor, and product strategist. His only defense against the charge of unbridled dilettantism is that he genuinely likes doing all these things. And one way or another, every one of these fields has played a role in his writing. Sebastian's acclaimed swashbuckling fantasy series, The Great Coats, was shortlisted for a 2014 Goodreads Choice Award for Best Fantasy, the Gemmell Morning Star Award for Best Debut, and many other awards out there. His YA fantasy series, Spellslinger, was also nominated for the Carnegie Medal and is published in more than a dozen languages. Check out Sebastian. He lives in Vancouver, Canada, with his lovely wife and two belligerent cats. Here's my interview with Sebastian right now. Sebastian, I want to welcome you to the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you here today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So why don't you introduce yourself to our readers and fans in the audience out there and tell us a little bit about how you got started on this writer journey, because you didn't actually start out wanting to be a writer.
Well, I think like a lot of people, I always loved the idea of seeing a book with my name on it on the shelves. But I guess my career in life, if you could call the mishmash of jobs and vocations I've had a career, probably started when I was about 15, 16. I was going camping by myself on an island off the coast of British Columbia, and I got stuck waiting for a ferry, and I think it was like 6 hours because I missed the ferry. And so I'm sitting on this rock, and I picked up a book from a bookstore on my way out, and it was called Bard by Keith Taylor. And Keith is an Australian writer, and he's still around, and he's a really great, really nice guy. In fact, before I started writing professionally, I actually forced myself to write him a letter. because, you know, it always feels a bit strange to sort of write an author, and I had never done it before. So I made myself do it, and he replied, and he's, like I say, a really nice guy. Anyway, I read this book, and it was called Bard, and it was about this 6th century Irish bard who was a, you know, guy who walked around, you know, traveling the world, going on adventures, fighting with swords, and telling stories and singing songs. And I remember this distinct feeling of sitting on this rock, staring out at the ocean, waiting for this ferry, finishing the book and thinking, that's the job I want. I want to be a bard. You know, everybody else in school had, you know, wanted to be whatever, actors, astronauts or things like that. And I wanted to be the one thing that was actually less plausible than astronaut. And so, of course, you know, there are no jobs for bards, but I ended up on this very bizarre career path where, you know, I was a fencer for a while and did fight choreography and sword fight choreography for the theater. And I was a professional musician. I still play music all the time. And I worked through all these sort of strange jobs that then culminated in being a novelist. So I finally got to be a bard, but I went through the really slow process to get there of just taking all the pieces and sort of doing those at different parts in my career.
You know, I think there's something to be said for that. And I think that, you know, I think of a bard as a person of wide experience traveling the world and sharing stories and but I think that your experiences leading up to that point, I would think a lot of bards would have to have that kind of qualifications, because you're traveling. You've got to be a jack of all trades. You've got to be able to do lots of things to survive on the road as a bard, right?
Oh, absolutely. You learn to pick up weird skills. I have this one really weird, I wouldn't call it an ability. My wife always laughs at it, which is, you know, when you go to another country, you might learn two or three words of a language, or you learn a few words of a language. And of course, you're hesitant to use anything. You start by asking people if they speak English, and almost, you know, most places we go in the world, somebody speaks English, or at least French, and French is my second language. I have this weird habit where I, knowing three or four words, I'll start trying to engage someone in conversation in their language, which makes no sense. But you sort of realize that, you know, 97% of communication is nonverbal. And so you can have these semi-bizarre conversations where you're reaching for words that you don't quite know, and the other person will suggest the word to you, and you'll go, yeah, I think that's it. And so I always think that it's a type of gregariousness, I guess. And I'm not really a very gregarious person by nature, but I love kind of getting to know other people's ways of speaking and talking and their sort of sensibilities. And that's something that I think partly came from sort of reading those books about bards and this notion of travel, that the travel isn't just, you know, you go take your camera, you go stay in hotels and see places. For me, all the best parts of traveling are kind of getting to meet people and realizing that not every culture has to be like your culture. That's something that's always sort of also driven me as a writer. One of my favorite things, you know, people always talk about world building, and it always gets down to sort of, you know, I put trees here and here's the magic system and here's five religions and the name of 6 different countries. But for me, the interesting part of world building is something that I pick up from traveling, which is realizing that the way that you do things in your own country, in your own culture, that it doesn't have to be that way, that there's completely other ways of doing just basic daily things, you know, from ranging from different kinds of foods that people like to different sort of cultural practices, different greetings. Like, you know, why do we greet a certain way? Why do we have two different words for, you know, hello and goodbye? Whereas, you know, I mean, this is the old classic cliche of, you know, that in Hawaii people will say aloha, and it can mean both. All those things are kind of interesting to me, and those all come out of that sort of love of travel.
And you talked about the world building aspect of it. That just really lends to making the stories you tell that much richer. Because, you know, I just started reading Spellslinger, and I'm just totally enjoying it. The first book in the Spellslinger series, and I have to say that one of the things that's caught me right away is the different, like the magic using culture versus the drovers or the people that are, you know, the wanderers that they've run into, that he runs into right in the beginning of the book. It's interesting to see their clash in cultures when they have their moments. And so I see that already just hearing you talk about it, just having read just a brief part of your book.
Yeah, well, for me, the best part, the reason to write fantasy is that it allows you to construct a world in which the themes that you're exploring are sort of manifest physically or even culturally. If you want to write about certain themes, I mean, people do this all the time anyway, but if you want to write about certain themes in our own world, like, for example, I'm very interested in idealism and friendship, and I'm interested in the clash between idealism and other sort of modes of being, ranging from, sort of philosophical pragmatism and faith and all these other sort of ways of approaching the world. I've always been really fascinated by idealism, and part of that comes from the fact that my writing in a lot of ways sort of comes more out of the swashbuckling tradition than it does the classic sort of epic fantasy tradition. And in swashbuckling, idealism plays a big role. So when you're writing fantasy, you get to kind of build a world in which the thematic issues that are kind of interesting to you and the character stuff that's interesting to you can manifest physically in the world. You can have different cultures that deal with different things. You can make magic mean something. So, a really good example is, and this is kind of, this is always a strange topic for people when I bring this up, but being Canadian, we often sort of look at the United States and the American relationship to guns as, and if you're a liberal like me, if you're kind of left to center, you sort of look at it through this lens of how strange it is. I'll meet perfectly nice people in the States, and then we get on the subject of guns, and they'll sort of be like, and I'll be like, why do you feel so passionate about this? Why do you need these guns? And they'll say, well, I need guns to protect myself, to protect my family and my country. And the most evil thing that anyone can seem to imagine is anyone coming and taking away the guns. And so it's very easy when you're kind of on my side of the political spectrum, or when you're, especially I think if you're Canadian, even though we have, lots of guns ourselves, but, we have more rules about them, to sort of look down at that. But then it occurred to me that all the fantasy novels I love about magic, are all ones in which, why is it so important that the hero gain magic? Well, it's so that they can protect themselves and their families and fight for their countries. And the most evil act in a typical magical fantasy novel is if someone tries to steal away your ability to do magic. And it occurred to me that that magic can be, makes a very good, not metaphor, because I don't want to sound like the book is just a bunch of metaphors. It's because the series really isn't. It's about being someone who's struggling to find themselves in the world. But that often we should look at magic less through this notion of how wonderful and wouldn't it be great if we all had it, and actually ask ourselves, why is it so important to us to have magic? Why do we obsess about this desire as fantasy readers to have magical powers ourselves? Because magic to me, and the way that I sort of use it in the context of Spellslinger, I sort of use it as a metaphor for bullets. And why do you want to have those so badly? Because almost all forms of magic that we read about in fantasy have to do with having control over other people. So, what's a fireball spell, right? I mean, a fireball spell is itself pretty much a bullet. Right? What's a good, you hit somebody with that, they're going to burn alive. It's a hideous thing to contemplate doing. But even if you have, often we dream of having telepathy. Well, how is telepathy different than spying on someone and violating their most private moments? Even when people talk about, there's all these other wonderful forms of magic where you kind of cause plants to grow faster, and bigger crops. And I always say, well, that's just genetically modified foods. And people will be kind of horrified by this notion. No, it's not. Magic is natural. And I'm always saying, well, no, magic's not. Magic is a desire to have power over other people in the natural world. And so it's much easier to explore those kind of issues in a meaningful way without writing a polemic or without kind of bashing people over the head with your message. If you're just exploring it a little more innocently inside a fantasy, and by innocently here, I don't mean, in a sort of a lighter, childish fashion at all. What I mean is that you can kind of create the context of this world where magic works a certain way, and then you as the writer can kind of explore it. And you may come up with the answer that you expected, or you may not. And in the case of Spellslinger and that series, Kellen's relationship to magic is always very fraught because he always kind of wants it, but because of his exposure to the Argosy, who are these kind of wandering gamblers who have no interest in magic, for them the greatest magic is all the sort of human things like dancing and music and knowing how to speak to other people in their own language. Because of his exposure to them, he always knows that desiring magic for its own sake comes with some negative consequences. So that's kind of what I love about it.
Yeah, it gives us the opportunity to share things in a way without beating people over the head with it. And maybe they come to the realization that the book has a theme, underlying theme. Maybe they don't. My first series was about a paramedic who treats supernatural creatures in the modern world, and that story is from my own experiences as a nurse and a paramedic, and it's basically talking about, you know, underserved populations needing healthcare. Of course, they have vampires and werewolves and all kinds of extra exploits along the way. But, you know, the underlying story is these people don't have health care and this guy finds a way to provide them health care. So I completely get what you're saying. Every now and then I'll get an email from somebody in the healthcare field who will pick up on that theme. A lot of other people just love the characters and love the different, you know, shenanigans they get involved with along the way. And that's fine. It's not there to prove a point. It's just, I think as an author, we can't help but write from a certain perspective.
It's true. But I think just to follow up on that, there's two aspects to that. If we want to call it sort of a layer of abstraction between our world and the fantasy world, there's two aspects to that. The one is we could sort of call it, you know, the notion that it's, you know, if it happens in space, it's easier to swallow, you know, like the old Star Trek thing where Star Trek, it's the original series, would explore themes that were difficult to put on television, but because they were set in space, because they were using, you know, an alien species as the metaphor for either a group or, on Earth or a philosophy or a political position on Earth, it became sort of more palatable. But that's just one part of it. Because for me, the important part, I think, from the standpoint of the writer, is that by having that layer of abstraction, it also gets you away from your presumptions. Like, for example, if I were going to write something about, if I were going to write a book about, well, just let's, sorry, not to bash on the US all the time, but because really it's a lovely country. But, you know, if I start wanting to write about American politics, because I'm really addicted to American politics, Canadian politics is often very staid and just not always exciting, whereas American politics is always full of excitement. But if I were to start writing about American politics, it would be very difficult for me not to simply take my existing positions, what I currently think about one politician or another, or one political party or another, or one political philosophy or another, and basically just kind of mash that into a pseudo narrative. You know, it's a story, but really it's just me saying what I think about these things. Whereas the minute that I abstract those into a fantasy world where, instead of it being, you know, so just so that I'm not talking about current politics, like, you know, I loved Al Gore, right? In 2000, I cried when he didn't become president. You know, but if I make Al Gore, you know, the forgotten prince or something in a fantasy novel, and if I make George Bush, you know, the other prince who became the king or whatever, there's a higher chance that I'll actually end up thinking more broadly and writing more sympathetically about both of them, and therefore maybe arriving not just at a more nuanced outcome from the standpoint of the reader, but also for me as a writer. I don't know if that makes sense, but you see what I mean about that.
Oh, absolutely.
That, yeah.
Yeah. Because I think that you can't write two sides. I mean, stories are about opposition in some way, shape or form. There's, you know, opposing forces at play, or if there wasn't a conflict, the story wouldn't go anywhere. And so in order to write both sides of that, you have to put yourself in the mind of both sides. You know, the best, I don't want to say everybody's always a bad guy, but the best bad guy in the story is the one who thinks he's doing it for the right reasons. And has a worldview that isn't necessarily evil. he's just made a mistake or is erring in his reasons for doing something almost unknowingly. The justification is not really there, but they try to achieve something. When you can do that, when you can make them sympathetic in some ways, I think they become almost a tragic character in many ways. And I think the people can identify as readers with both sides of a challenging equation like that.
Well, and they can identify with them without having to feel like things that are very important in their current, in their own context of their own lives, aren't therefore being betrayed in some sense. So I always think the best example of this, because it's the one everybody knows, is Game of Thrones. You know, Game of Thrones, first of all, half, if not more, of the characters are crappy in ways that our worst politicians aren't as awful about. And we can sympathize with all of them. I mean, we can sympathize with Jaime Lannister. Now, Game of Thrones, if he was writing that with an explicit set of references where he said, look, Cersei Lannister is really Donald Trump, you know, as soon as that happened, that would force the audience into all of these different positions that would make it impossible for them to explore the themes of that story, in the sense that the moment that, you know, sometimes we need to sympathize with Cersei, but there's people for whom, if you start to explore being sympathetic towards someone they don't like politically, and, you know, whether that's Donald Trump or some people don't like, you know, Hillary Clinton or whatever else, as soon as we start doing that, people sort of feel like, oh my God, like I just read this latest chapter in the new book, or I just saw the episode of the TV series, and how dare they rehabilitate, you know, let's say Hillary Clinton, if you're someone who doesn't like Hillary Clinton, they're rehabilitating Hillary Clinton by showing Cersei Lannister as having a conscience. And so it gets our backs up against the wall, you know, depending on which position you're in. And in fact, even if, when you think of the fact that, you know, George R. R. Martin has openly talked about the fact that the War of the Roses is the inspiration for Game of Thrones. If he was sort of explicit about which side were the Yorks and which side were the Lancasters in a way that most people understood, there would be people who said, you know, how dare you sort of try to make it as if the English were the good guys, or, you know, whatever else. So every time the closer that we get to the point where the reader or the audience is being told, yes, this character is a stand-in for a real person or a real community or something like that, the more it forces us to take sides, not based on the kind of empathy that that reading is so wonderful at giving us the opportunity to experience, but based on what does it say about me, what does it say about my world, my own life, if I like this. Right. Like, that's the thing we all want to avoid, is the moment where we you know, I think everyone's biggest fear in the modern era is to read a new book and go, oh, my God, this was the greatest book ever, and talk about online how much they love this book and have someone say, yeah, I don't know if you know, but that was written by a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and the whole book was meant to convert people to, you know, right, you know, white supremacy. And then you go, oh, my God, you know, the fact that I like this means there's something horrible about me. Right. So that's why that distance, that kind of layer of abstraction that fantasy affords, I think gives us an opportunity to explore things without having to attach them to specific people or groups in a way that makes it unpalatable for the audience.
And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, when I don't really often see the themes of my books until after I've finished them. And then I realize, you know, some challenge I've been going through worked its way into the book because subconsciously I was working my way through something. And I've seen it in, you know, several different series that I've written. So I get it. And I think that they all serve a purpose to help people see each other in a kinder light, even though they might have opposing viewpoints. That's always something I strive to do is let people get along in stories and teach people a lot of different things. But like you said, do it in a way that is fun and fantasy and has magic and creatures and all sorts of things. Let's talk a little bit about, I know you've got a new book coming out in July. That's a carry on from your Greatcoats series. Now you have, I believe, 4 books in that series now. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's the Greatcoats Quartet was a 4-book swashbuckling series about 3 of these sword fighting traveling magistrates. And that was all sort of that idea was drawn from an actual phenomenon in the 12th century in England, which were called the Justices Itinerant. And it was because, the word court, when we think of a trial, court actually referred to the king's court. And so that's where things were adjudicated. But the king can't be everywhere at once, and people can't always bring all of their legal claims to the king's court, right? That's a lot of travel. And so they started sending out these justices itinerant who would ride these circuits that might be 6 months long, where they'd go to villages. And if there was a legal dispute in that village, they would kind of hang on to it for however long it took until the itinerant justice turned up. And then they'd present the case and it would be adjudicated. And in fact, that tradition also existed in the United States. Well, that's where the term circuit court comes from.
Absolutely. I was just going to say that.
Yeah. And in fact, there's an old, it may be apocryphal, but there's old stories about how Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, when he was a lawyer, traveled with another lawyer and a judge, and they would go on these circuits, and the judge would, they'd come up to a case in a town, and the judge would say, all right, Lincoln, you're going to represent this guy, and other lawyer, you're representing this woman. And now, we're going to have a trial. And then they all get on their horses and ride to the next town. And there's a story that sometimes when they didn't need 2 lawyers, the judge would actually go fishing and tell Lincoln to be the judge, which just shows you kind of like how funny our notions of the law actually are. So the Greatcoats was sort of inspired by that, but with a lot more sword fighting and swashbuckling. And so that series, the 4-book series, that story is complete. And the new series, which is a bit more of a slightly more complex series, starts with a book called Play of Shadows, which, assuming I get this 3rd draft wrapped up in time, will be launching, I think, worldwide in July. And Play of Shadows, following off what we were talking about at the top of this notion of seeing things that we think of as normal in our own culture and realizing they could be different, came about from the fact that I see a lot of theater plays. My wife and I like to go to the theater, especially, both my World Rights publishers are in London. So I'm in London quite a bit, and London's got great theater. And I mean, lots of places have great theater, but the farther away you get from sort of New York or London, the more that great theater tends for me to happen in community theaters rather than sort of the big production houses. But anyway, I had this thought, this weird thought, and it, that started when I think it emerged from the fact that there was a time when I was doing fight choreography, when I was choreographing sword fights, and I'd been flown out to England to choreograph the sword fights for this unusual production of Richard III that was put on by this group, and they were using the historical Richard rather than the Shakespearean Richard, and so they wanted to sort of put on this play in which Richard III was in effect the hero, the tragic hero of the story, rather than the sort of monstrous villain that Shakespeare portrayed him as. And so that dichotomy always had this weird thought in my head, or created that weird thought in my head where I thought, how come we don't have these sort of actors that maybe we give them a special name, we call them veristors, and they're supposed to be kind of like the sacred actors. And we have this sort of kind of traditional belief that when one of these actors takes the stage to play the historical figure, that they actually truly channel the spirit of that figure. And so while you're watching the play, a big battle scene where there's Richard III on the stage, you're actually watching the spirit of Richard III. And so the play changes a little bit all the time. And the other actors have to work around this sacred actor that we call a veristor. And I thought, I wonder why we don't have that. 'Cause you wouldn't have to believe that it really happened. We have all kinds of traditions around celebrity that we attribute almost supernatural mechanisms to that we all know aren't real. And so I kind of got interested in this notion of what would happen to a bit player, a small actor in one of these famous productions in this fantasy city, where all of a sudden something took them over and the spirit of a character took them over, and they suddenly said something that was so horrible to the traditions of that city that it would put their lives and the lives of all their fellow actors immediately at risk. You know, the equivalent is someone's putting on a stage play let's take Hamilton, right? You know, you put on a stage play of Hamilton, which is a fantastic play, by the way, if anyone out there hasn't seen it, it's totally worth it. All the hype is true. But you're watching Hamilton, and Hamilton's supposed to sort of be the hero of the story. And imagine if one of the characters suddenly accused Hamilton of a horrible crime that made them, you know, virtually a traitor to the United States. And that's kind of what happens in the story, and that's what sets it off. And so it's a big swashbuckling tale that involves the theater and actors and spirits of, you know, dead princes. And so it's just a lot of fun.
It sounds like it. And I've got it down here that it's going to be released July 23rd. You can pre-order it now, which actually gives you plenty of time to start off with Traitor's Blade and learn the lore of the whole Great Cloak's world, so that your great coat's world, so that you're ready to jump in with the new book when it comes out. One quick question for you before we close out, because we're kind of getting towards the end. You said earlier that you reached out to that author in the beginning and felt like it was strange to write to an author. What do you say to your readers that might feel the same way about reaching out to you?
Well, I try to remember, I put in the back of pretty much all my books that the best part, as it turns out, of being an author is when readers write to you. And so I get letters all the time, and I love getting letters. I love getting emails and notes, and you know, people when they send they'll send fan art, and I love all that stuff because it allows you to connect with the people who are really genuinely touched, not necessarily by my writing, but they're touched by the themes that I'm exploring in my writing. In other words, they and I have something in common. There's something about swashbuckling, or there's something about idealism, or there's something about the Spellslinger's take on magic that resonates with them. And it's a wonderful feeling as an author, because it's not just somebody praising you, which is, you know, always nice, but isn't the point. It's the fact that you realize that there's other people out there who care about some of the themes that you care about.
It really is a joy. I feel the same way. I look forward to those emails that come in every now and then, that, or Facebook messages or whatever they are, where people reach out and you know, make a comment about a book they're reading, or ask a question about when the next book in a series is coming out. And that's always wonderful to hear. What's your preferred method of communication with folks? Do you prefer email, or do you just say, get a hold of me however you can?
Well, I try to respond anytime someone gets hold of me through whatever means they want. My absolute favorite is when someone just writes me a letter, like a physical letter, because then it's something real that, you know, went through space, as it were. But for most people, the easiest is to just go to my website, which is decastell.com. So decastell.com/contact. Or just click on the contact link there under author, and they can just write me a note there. That's the one I'm going to see the fastest. I try to reply when people tweet, and I try to catch it when they write me on Facebook, but I have all kinds of problems with Facebook Messenger. So sometimes it's months after when all of a sudden it shows me somebody wrote to me, and I always feel terrible because I try to respond to people as quickly as I can. So definitely reaching out to me through the website is probably the most convenient way.
Yeah, and I urge people to head over. Your website is spectacular, by the way, and there's all your books are there. Lots of information about you and what you have going on, and of course the contact information as well. Sebastian, it's great having you on the show. I appreciate you taking some time, and we had some great conversations. I hope people enjoyed this, and maybe when you have something else coming out in the future, please reach out and we can get you back on.
Thanks, I'd be delighted.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. Make sure you catch up with us for a whole lot more from the whole Fantasy Focus community, both on Facebook and over at fantasy-focus.com. Leave a comment on this episode and let me know what's on your mind. Also, while you're on the website over at fantasy-focus.com, you'll find each podcast episode post and links to subscribe to the show. So if you've enjoyed this episode and you want to catch more of them, you don't want to miss any of them, maybe potentially missing your own favorite author, you'll want to get the mobile app that you use for getting podcasts and subscribe to the show. There are links right there, no matter what your mobile device, iOS, Android, even by email, there are links there that will allow you to subscribe and make sure you don't miss any episodes. We have some amazing authors coming up in the next few months. You won't want to miss any of them, especially the very next episode with A.M. Rycroft. That's it for now, though. The Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast is closing down for the episode. As always, I'm your host, Jamie Davis, author of Fun Fantasy Reads. Don't forget to follow me on Facebook. You can find me on my page at Jamie Davis Books, or in my Fun Fantasy Readers group, or at my website, jamiedavisbooks.com. Whatever you do, though, subscribe to this show. Come back. Catch the next podcast. And in the meantime, don't forget to keep your eyes open, folks, because whether you know it or not, there's magic all around you.